For the week of April 27th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 233, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Alamo Gordo, New Mexico, I'm Michael Giltz.
Ah, so while I was away in Mexico, not the new version, the old version, the classic Mexico.
Classic.
That you were in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Apparently, I can guess that you were
digging up dirt.
Yeah, you were probably part of that team in that landfill that was trying to find all those old Atari 2600 cartridges of that ET video game.
Yeah, tell us the legend.
Well, the legend is that Atari, you know, from 1976 to 82, they were kind of a big deal. No pun intended. And they built this video game, E.T. They kind of had a marketing agreement with, I guess it was Universal, to build...
At the last second.
At the last second, correct. It wasn't something they had planned on doing.
Well, because no one thought E.T. would be a big hit. I mean, nobody. And Spielberg didn't. It was a small little film. And, like, you know, what's it called? M&M's turned them down. They're like, no, we don't want to be in your stupid movie. And so that's why Reese's Pieces is in the film. And there were not, things were not in place for merchandising. And then suddenly the film was a big hit. And in 5 weeks, Atari had to turn around a video game.
And they decided that with that much work to do, they should put one whole person on it. And so there was one developer who worked on this video game because nobody else wanted to, Howard Scott Warshaw, who, by the way, was at the landfill when they discovered these cartridges. But the game was so bad and so complex and so difficult to play.
Not complex. It was buggy. It was yes. Impossible to play. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody who bought one, and not very many people did, returned it. And so, you know, Atari in financial trouble, they moved all their stuff offshore. They basically loaded all these trucks and buried all these video games. Not just E.T.
They had so many copies of E.T. the video game that they dumped them in a landfill. It was dubbed the worst video game of all time.
Yes.
And that was, the legend sprang up that it was so bad, they just took hundreds of thousands of copies and dumped them in the ground. Turns out it was actually true.
Right. It was an urban legend among video game folks. And you're right, Michael.
They thought it was an urban legend.
Yeah. And it was an urban truism because they discovered all these video cartridges in a landfill in, as you said, Alamogordo, New Mexico, over the weekend.
The saddest part about this story is that this is a tiny little town. And the mayor said, hopefully this will help bring some tourists to our town. I'm like, oh my God.
Yes, what with
that's
what?
That's the saddest thing I've ever heard. They've dumped some video games in the ground and you're hoping people will start to stop that. She says, sadly, most people just pass on through.
Yeah,
you'd grab onto what you can, I guess. And people should grab onto this show while they can. What will we be talking about?
Well, you know, I think when people show up in Alamogordo, New Mexico, they'll have a shovel in one hand and the Atari 2600, the classic video game unit, console in their other hand. And, you know, on today's show, we're actually going to be talking about classics, both figuratively and literally. And what I mean by that is we're going to be talking about some classical entertainment, opera, and we'll also be talking about an old classic topic here on Showbiz Sandbox, streaming media and net neutrality, or the lack thereof. Yay. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world, according to RentTrack, for the second weekend in the row is The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
That's impossible, Michael. That's impossible. It hasn't opened yet.
That's right. That's why we focus on worldwide box office. Spidey has gotten a jump on the North American market. It's opened up overseas. 2 weekends ago, Sperling was away, so we missed a weekend. It was the number one movie, made about $65 million. This week, it made $67 million. Its worldwide box office total is $132 million, and that's all before it opens up here in North America on May 2nd, my birthday.
But, you know, $167 million, $132 million, you said? Yeah, you know, that's what I'd like to call, chump change.
It's a very strong start to the film. It's not open everywhere overseas. It's a
40,
good beginning.
40
it's
territories.
Doing very well. It's, what?
40 territories.
Well, that's a lot, but that's not all of them. I mean, there's like 70 or 80 territories, aren't there?
That's right. Yes. And I think it still has, 42 territories to go?
Yeah, it's got a lot of territories to go. So this is a terrific start in the markets where it's opened. It's doing very well compared to the last Spider-Man movie. It's off to a very strong start. It's getting some good reviews early here. My friend saw it and said it was good. He liked it better than the last one.
Actually, it's 30 countries abroad, including it still has to open in Brazil, China, and the last time the previous Amazing Spider-Man opened in China, it earned $48 million, which was more than any other international market. It earned just...
I read that, but that doesn't sound right. No other country grossed more than $50 million?
Well...
That sounds low to me.
Well, $50 million in one territory is a lot.
Yeah. All right. Well, number two around the world is Rio 2. That animated film grossed $41 million. It's at just under $350 million worldwide, and it's doing great overseas. It's kind of tripling what it's doing domestically. At number three is The Other Woman. This is the Cameron Diaz romantic comedy, another $37 million. It's at $45 million and counting. That was the number one movie in North America, by the way. It displaced Captain America, who had been number one for 3 weeks in a row. That puts Captain America down to number four. It goes to another $32 million. It's at $650 million worldwide. This sucker is still tearing along towards about, I guess, I don't know, $800 million?
Well, $645 million worldwide.
That's where it is right now, but I'm saying where we'll end up. We're still making $30 million bucks a week, so I'm thinking maybe it's going to get between $700 and $800 million.
I think you're probably right. I don't think it's going to cross the billion-dollar mark, but no. I think you're right. It's going to $800 million. Let's go with $800 million.
I'll take $800 million, Alex. At number five is one of another new debuts. This is a Chinese film. It's called My Old Classmate. It's a romance about two people who really liked each other in high school and college, but they drifted apart. And now a friend's getting married, and that brings them back together again. And don't be surprised if sparks fly. It's more of a drama than a comedy and has a really cute trailer. I've put the link to the trailer in our show notes. It's what they had was they had people recreate their old school photos with their chums. So like if it was three girls leaning on a fence, then you'd see the three adult women leaning on a fence, almost often wearing the same clothing. It was very clever, very cute, about 2.5 minutes long, and about 100 different groups of people in China all recreating their old school photos. I don't mean class photos, but like casual snaps that they took with their friends. It's a cute trailer.
So this wasn't necessarily people who had anything to do with the movie. These were...
No, these were real people. Okay. Just, you know, they just to create buzz about the film, they did this. And it grossed $16 million, which is a hell of a big opening.
You know what? I think I might actually write something about that on Celluloid Junkie. I think that's a really interesting way to promote a film.
Yeah, I mean, we've been seeing those recreating old photos things. You see them. There was that story about online where the four brothers or whatever had done it every year for like 30 years, and they did the stop motion time lapse depiction of them through their lives from like little kids to middle age, and now, you know, they're in their 40s and 50s, and it's kind of touching and cool. And so this idea was taken and used to promote this movie. $60 million in opening weekend. That's why I think $48 million for Spidey in China or anywhere, it just doesn't seem that high to me. I mean, movies can hit $100 million in China.
That said, The Amazing Spider-Man 2 was 2-3 years ago, correct?
Amazing Spider-Man.
Yes, The Amazing
Spider-Man. The reboot.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say... Okay, yes. The reboot was 2 or 3 years ago, and there were far fewer screens in China than there are today.
Sure, I just don't think that market is twice as big as all other markets in the world. But anyway, number six around the world is Transcendence, the Johnny Depp flop, a big, big flop. $15 million it made this weekend. It's at $51 million worldwide. And number seven is Heaven is for Real. And unless you live in North America, you have no idea what we're talking about. Greg Kinnear must love this film. I mean, he had his TV show Rake was a huge bomb on Fox. It was airing on Friday nights. And when it ended, it had like literally the lowest viewership for a primetime show on a broadcast network in practically history. I mean, it was really low rated, but thank God he's got this film bumping back his credibility. It's a nice little modest hit. Modest, what am I talking about? It's a pretty good hit. $13 million this weekend, $52 million so far and counting. And number eight is Noah, another $13 million. That's at $320 million worldwide. So it's just edging into profitability. And well, down below, that's not even on the list here in the worldwide, but also in the U.S. you have God is Dead. God's Not Dead. God is Dead. That's the different movie. God's Not Dead is another faith-based film. That's also at $52 million in North America. What only bothers me about these movies, and more power to them for making the movie and getting it seen, is how people act like Hollywood has just for the first time discovered the Bible. Since the silent era, movies about faith have been made by big Hollywood studios. Now that they've discovered, hey, we can make our own faith-based films and do them ourselves and release them ourselves and reach our audience and sometimes cross over, that's great. You know what? Melvin Van Peebles was there 40, 50 years ago. So was Tom Laughlin with Billy Jack. People who have felt underserved by Hollywood have been doing that for decades, and welcome to the club. That's great. But unlike all those other people, unlike Blacks and Latinos and Asians and gays and anybody else who felt ignored by Hollywood, people of faith have had big blockbuster movies made just for them all throughout Hollywood history. The list of big blockbuster films based on the Bible or based on stories of faith is endless.
Well, having been a creative executive in the motion picture industry trying to develop movies, I can tell you that, you know, for a while, people, you know, the executives and the studios were interested in this Bible thing, but A, they could not find anybody to buy the rights from, and B, they couldn't get the writer to do a few revisions.
At number 9 around the world is Divergent, another $13 million. That's at $232 million worldwide. It's sort of slowing down a little bit. I'm not sure how many territories it has to open up, and it's in 75 territories right now. I'm not sure how much life is left in this. The studio has already said, hey, not only are we making a sequel, we're going to make all of them, and the last book is going to become two movies. But I don't know. I would look at this and be very wary about making a sequel, wouldn't you? Much less stretching it out to four films instead of three.
Well, if I did, I would make it on a budget. I would, you know, if I was going to continue this as a franchise.
Books get bigger and bigger. They're more elaborate and more expensive.
Right. And of course, the talent wants, more and more money.
You're going to make two and three. They're already locked in for some serious money.
Yeah, so, yeah, $232 million worldwide. Ugh.
I would feel like I got away with something and walk away. I'd feel like, oh, I'm lucky. We didn't lose our shirt. Let's call it a day. But there you go. And number, maybe it'll do great on DVD. And number 10 is Brick Mansions. What the heck is that about?
I have no idea. I'm going to say that it's about...
Oh, that's the Paul Walker film.
Oh, yes. This is one of his last films.
That's right. It's a non-racing film. It's one of the last films from Paul Walker. It opened in a couple territories. It made $11 million. And number 11 is Iceman 3D. This is another Chinese film with a strong opening. This is a Chinese action comedy starring Donnie Yen, who, of course, also did the action stunts. He oversaw them. It's about a Ming warrior frozen for 400 years and then brought back to life. The tagline says it's ancient martial arts versus modern weaponry. My money is on ancient martial arts.
Okay.
That's just a good guess. But yeah, that's a big weekend in at the box office in China. They're really tearing it up. And number 12 is a French film, which I am very improperly translating into English. What did we do to God? Or why God? Why? I'm not quite sure what it is. And I don't even know how to say it. I mean, it looks like good God is what it looks like. It says, Qu'est-ce qu'on a fait au bon Dieu? Oh my God, that was horrible. I apologize. Anyway, it's a French comedy. It's about Catholic parents who are thrown for a loop when their four daughters each marry a man of a different faith. It's adorable. It's funny. You learn a little bit about Hinduism and Muslim, I'm sure. I'm just guessing. But I can imagine a Hollywood remake in about 5 minutes. And number 13 is The Grand Budapest Hotel. $7 million, $130 million worldwide. Frozen is still making money. Lego is still making money. And down at number 16 is Spanish Affair. This is a movie that I think opened up... a few weeks ago, we've been calling it by the Spanish title, Otro Apellidos Vascos. But apparently in English, they're calling it Spanish Affair, which is obviously not a direct translation. But it's about a guy in Seville who falls in love with a girl from the Basque region and romance ensues.
Well, and I think the reason it's called Spanish Affair, I think, what is it, Universal that's releasing this? That's what they called the movie internally. I don't know. It's that Spanish Affair movie.
That's right. So that's the weekend box office. And of course, one big detail came about last year's box office, and that is the cost to go see a movie in North America. Ticket prices actually fell.
Well,
that's what they
you know,
say.
They always fall in the first quarter and then they rise. And, I don't pay any attention to this whole, the average.
Wasn't this last year?
Oh, was it the whole year?
Yes. No, it was. All right. Let me double check. I believe it was ticket prices for all of 2013.
Oh,
let me check. You're right. First quarter.
I'm sorry.
So why do they always fall in the first quarter?
Because people go back to work after the holidays. They're not watching
the
movies.
Ticket prices.
Yeah, so to attract...
Theater has not lowered its ticket price.
Yeah, but I think some theaters do. And I also
really?
Think... Yeah, I think... Plus, I'd have to go back to our show from about a year ago with Patrick Corcoran from NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, who explain to us how it is they derive that price, that average right. ticket price, which had something to do with ticket sales. So
it had very little to do. It was just like they just took it was just a very, very rough rendering of what ticket price. They take total box office divided by the number of tickets and say that's the average ticket price.
Yeah, I don't think that's it, though. I think we'd have to
go
back.
That's what they do. That's what we found shocking.
Oh, okay.
I'm almost certain that when they say, or they say the annual box office was $4 billion, we claim that the average ticket price is this amount, and therefore we divide that dollar amount into the total box office, and that's how we decide how many tickets are sold, which is right. Which is crazy. So how they determine the ticket price, I don't know.
I'm going to go back and listen.
Right. Well, anyway, I would have thought that the ticket prices weren't falling so much as people were just buying fewer premium tickets. They're not buying as much 3D or IMAX.
And?
That would lower the total ticket price.
I thought you had some.
If you
some
sell
like...
more tickets to 2D rather than an extra $3, $5, or $8 to see a movie in 3D IMAX, well, then, of course, the average ticket price is going to fall. But it's not that, you know, studios and theater companies are lowering their prices. It's just that people are ignoring the high price premium tickets. Was my prediction.
That was your prediction or your read, your analysis.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Because I thought maybe you had some proof there and I was going to, you know, ask you for
my
something.
Proof is that we've been looking at the box office for 3D films and seeing them drop every single time a new one comes out. The amount of people buying tickets for the 3D showings is lower and lower for the past 2 years, very consistently.
At least here in North America, there are territories where...
We're talking about the ticket price in North America, and thus okay. I'm talking about ticket sales for 3D. Believe me, the rest of the world will catch up.
Well, now, what is this stuff about Zack Snyder that you have here in our movie notes?
They're doing a Justice League movie, and they want Zack Snyder to be the one to do it. Clearly, what's his name who did The Dark Knight? Christopher Nolan said no.
Yes, exactly. And quite honestly, after seeing the Superman reboot, might I suggest finding, I don't know, anybody but Zack Snyder?
Well, they, you know, that movie grossed $687 million worldwide. However, it also cost $225 million to make and got mixed reviews. So it was profitable, but just barely. Now, the question is, they want to have the big Marvel thing. They're so excited. Everybody wants a Marvel thing. We got all these different movies feeding off of each other, and they all make tons of money. It's so easy. But what are they doing? They made a Man of Steel movie. Now they're doing a sequel in which you're going to have Batman. It's called Superman versus Batman. And there will be cameos by Wonder Woman and Cyborg. And then they're doing a Justice League movie.
Ugh.
Right away. Right. That's not even close to what Marvel did. Marvel did Iron Man, and then it released Thor, and then it released Captain America, and then it released Iron Man 2, and then it did the Avengers. You had three different franchises launched successfully. And then even a sequel, which was wildly successful, before they got to the Avengers. In this, they're just doing one movie. They're doing Superman.
Yes, Batman. But you know what? I have to say, capturing lightning in a bottle, just it looked so easy. Everybody's going to try and do it now.
Right, but they're not even following the blueprint. They're not even doing. They're not releasing a Wonder Woman movie. Not releasing an Aquaman movie. God help them after the HBO series Entourage. They're not releasing a movie of a secondary character that people thought they didn't care about, like, say, Cyborg, and making it into a successful film, and then leading into this Justice League. You know, they're not doing the work. They released one movie so far, and it didn't even get very good reviews, and it was barely profitable, as opposed to Iron Man, which got rapturous reviews and was a massive worldwide hit.
Do you know what is profitable?
What?
Broadcast television, which is precisely why broadcasters went after Aereo. When Aereo, you remember Aereo, Michael, right?
I mean, do we have to?
And, well, for our listeners who may not know what Aereo is, here in the United States, it is this, I don't know, it's this service that rents you an antenna and a virtual DVR in the cloud and will stream over the air or free view. If you're in certain countries, it's free view. You know, all what's being broadcast by the broadcasters, they will stream into your...
It's sort of like a cable service, but they're doing it over the internet, and they're providing only the over-the-air channels, the major networks that everyone should have access to for free. They can't do this because they're not a cable provider, and they're not making deals and signing agreements with the networks, so they've done a workaround, which is they're saying, well, we're not providing this TV service a la cable. What we're doing is just letting people rent antennas. So that they can access the free over-the-air service. And everyone who rents from us gets their own antenna, and everyone has their own cloud DVR, and they can access only the over-the-air free broadcast that everyone is supposed to be able to access. And so that's why we're legal. It's a cute little gimmick. It may be legal, and it's been heard by the Supreme Court. It's rushed through the courts and gone all the way to the Supreme Court, where they're trying to figure out whether this is illegal or whether this is fair. And the justices are a little freaked out because on the one hand, if they rule for Aereo, they think that they're going to be, you know, putting a stake through the heart of cable and network television.
Right.
On the other hand, if they rule against Aereo, they're worried that this will impact cloud services and other technological innovations that Aereo is riding on the back of.
Right, because that kind of boils down to the public performance question. And what that means is that, you know, if you're broadcasting something and it becomes a public performance, and what Aereo is saying is, no, these are all private performances. It is one antenna for one individual. That individual has to tune in to whatever piece of content they want. Now, cloud computing, all of these cloud lockers where you upload something to Dropbox and then you can...
pictures of my baby or recent episodes of Game of Thrones.
Right. And then you stream it back to yourself. That is considered a private performance, not a public performance, because it's one-to-one. And what
now, Sperling, I know that you've read the transcript of the debate in front of the justices.
Yes.
They have oral arguments. It's a half an hour for each judge, or is it a half an hour total?
It's a half an hour total.
Half an hour for each lawyer, or a half an hour total?
It's a half an hour for each side. So
okay.
One
so
side
it's
gets
an hour in total before the judges. They make their claim, they make their argument, and then the justices pepper them with arguments. You've read this, and what is your evaluation of the Supreme Court justices and their knowledge of technology?
Yeah, I would be surprised if any one of them could program their VCR or their DVR.
They probably have a VCR, right?
Exactly.
That's what you get. They're so out of the loop as far as what's a DVR, what are we talking about, what is this? They have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, it's really sad. And quite honestly, I read this transcript and thought to myself, oh my goodness, these people are going to, they know about as much about technology as they do about how politics works, where they keep kind of saying, yeah, no, you can just donate as much as you want to any politicians.
Oh, now you're getting into different legal. Now you're getting into, perhaps they know as much about technology as you do about the law.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's probably true, too.
Right.
But
so what happens is they have to deal with 10,000 different areas every year. You know, about cattle raising and about, you know, agriculture and about copyright and about medical ethics and all these different things. And they're not experts in all these issues, but they are experts in the law. But when a new case comes before them and they ask their questions, sometimes they look awfully ignorant.
Yes, that is true. Now, part of this issue is the Copyright Act and whether something is or is not a cable off, you know, a cable operator. You know, a lot of the justices felt like, well, gee, Aereo, you're kind of using all these antennas to get around, you know,
right,
to loophole. And the answer is, yes, that is correct. So if you change the law, then yes, we would be. But that's not what, you know, if you're going to interpret the law, then what we're doing is actually legal.
Because right. If you don't like it, change the law.
Exactly. And
so what do you think is going to happen based on the questions that the justices asked? And their behavior, you can sort of guess, oh, she seems to be pro or he seems to be anti. Where do you think it's going to fall?
Oh, I think
nobody knows, right?
I think they're going to try and do a now. Yes, this was one of those instances where sometimes the questioning from the justices gives you some way to read the tea leaves. But in this case, with the Supreme Court, nine justices.
Eight, I believe. One of them had to recuse himself.
No,
for some reason.
Sam Alito decided not to recuse himself.
Oh!
Which,
oh, really?
Yes, he came back in at the last minute. One of the justices who had recused himself, and nobody, I don't think they...
No one knew why he recused himself, and no one knows why he's come back in.
Yes, which kind of, I don't know.
Maybe he canceled his Hulu subscription.
Who knows? Maybe he knew more about technology than everybody else. I don't know, but I think they're going to try and do a very narrow ruling. You could tell that they didn't want to be a part of this at all. And they just, you can, from their questioning, they just seem so frustrated.
Headache.
Yeah. Why are you involving us in this? And if we go one way, we basically obliterate a whole business model of retransmission consent agreements, which we talk about so often here on Showbiz Sandbox. If we go the other way, we could, obliterate cloud computing and innovation. It's a lose-lose. We don't want a part of this.
Well, the one thing we agree on is that the Aereo lawyer, and there may be strategic reasons why, but didn't make the case that we thought he should make, which is simply that, hey, all we're talking about is the over-the-air free broadcasts, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, and PBS. These are supposed to be available to everyone. They're free. They have to make them available to everyone. And we're just allowing people a different way to access what is supposed to be free and available to them. And if they want to access this through our antennas rather than sticking one on their roof, or maybe they're in New York City and an antenna on the roof doesn't work, what's wrong with that? We're not stealing HBO. We're not stealing Comedy Central. We're not getting between any deals of anyone. This is free over-the-air television. Everyone is supposed to have access to it, and we're just aiding and abetting that.
Yes, well, and then the justices went in the direction of, well, really, this isn't about whether you're a cable network or at all, or whether it's private performance or public performance under the copyright law. It's a reproduction right. Well, the lawyer for Aereo pointed out, well, guess what, guys? You know, if that's the case, the broadcasters chose not to go down that road because they'd already lost that fight in the 1980s.
With VCRs.
So they specifically chose not to go down that road. Otherwise, it would have, fallen on stare decisis and you know, previous rulings.
Well, we'll have to wait until I think it's June or July when they release all their final rulings from the season, unless they, you know, release their ruling earlier. But it ain't over till the fat lady sings.
Oh, I see what you're doing there, because our next topic is about opera. Right? Is that what you're trying to...
That's right. I've been going to a lot of opera. We've gone to Cannes with our friend Steven, who runs a film editing company.
Jump Cut Creative is his new company, Steven Garrett.
That's right. And he's a terrific film editor and trailer cutter, and he does a lot of work for Lincoln Center. And he gets to go to the opera, and luckily, he gets to take me. So, you know, when he doesn't have... When his wife doesn't want to go or doesn't have someone else, I am the standby opera guy. So I'm always there ready to go to the opera and check out the theater, you know, check out the performances with him. And it's been great. I've seen more opera in the last year and a half, 2 years than I have in my entire life.
Now, were you there?
No.
Okay. Well, I guess you know exactly what I'm...
Angrily.
Okay. Well, what happened? Okay, so let's talk about the Met for a second, because I have been to an opera here in Los Angeles where Placido Domingo is the creative director or artistic director. He's up there. He basically helps run the LA Opera with James Conlon, who is the conductor. And so I've been to an opera where, and it was a 5.5 hour opera. It started at like 6 PM because it was so darn long. It was Wagner's Parsifal, which is Placido Domingo's biggest, you know, it's one of his best roles. And the lights dim halfway at the beginning of the performance. And who is the first voice we hear? There he is, Placido Domingo, just like we wanted, playing in his... No, he's actually over the intercom, over the public address system, saying that, unfortunately, he cannot go on because he is not feeling well and he it would not be fair. The groan from the audience was so loud. People had flown in from Maine and from, like, the other side.
Of course, there are Wagner fanatics who come to the Ring Cycle, wherever it is in the world.
And so they put on the understudy, and what... A hard job. 5.5 hours of understudy. It was just like, oh boy.
But did he do a decent job?
He did an okay job. I wouldn't know. You know, I'd never seen the opera before, but
if you didn't leave in disgust, he did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
At the Met, they had a similar thing. They're putting on Cinderella, known as La Cenerentola.
Rossini's opera.
And the great bel canto tenor Juan Diego Flores was out sick.
And now Flores is, he's a really good opera singer. I mean, he is.
He's a hugely popular star. And he was replaced by the tenor from Mexico. Hello, Mexico. Javier Camarena.
Yes.
And he took over the lead role and stopped the show. Literally stopped the show.
Yeah, he stormed off. He didn't like what he was doing. That's it. I'm out of here.
He was so good in one aria that the show stopped and he was begged for an encore, which does not happen. In fact, the Met has a policy. No encores allowed. We're not going to do it. And yet it's happened a few times.
Yes. Well, and ironically, it happened for Juan Diego Flores.
Right. The guy that he replaced. He's done it twice.
Yes. Not once, but twice.
2008, 2012. And before that, it was Luciano Pavarotti. Those are the only people in like 50 years to stop the show. And it happened again at this performance at the Met. I wasn't there. Steven wasn't there. But he's going Friday night. We're taping on Monday the 28th. So it's Friday, May 2nd that he's going. He already has a guest. He's not taking me. Well, and it's not clear whether Juan Diego Flores or Camarena will be the one performing.
because Juan Diego Flores was supposed to return for the later performances of this Rossini opera.
Well, as soon as he's well, of course.
Right.
But, you know, he was so good and Juan was not available. He went back on again. Again, he did it again. I mean, again, he did an encore. It was just, you know, so crazy. And so now people are like, oh, I wonder if Flores will return for the live performance, which goes out over movie theaters, which takes place on May 10th, the Mets live in HD series. Do you think Juan Diego Flores will return for that, or will Mr. Camarena keep doing it? Trust me, if Juan Diego Flores can even open his mouth, he will be there for the live in HD and not Juan Camarena. Like, oh, let me step aside and give him his... No, no, no. He wants to come back and show he's the real deal as well.
Yes, well...
There's no like, oh, what a wonderful triumph. Please go on in place of me and let people around the country see your performance. No, no, no. If you know anything about opera, you know that isn't going to happen.
Well, in programs for the Metropolitan Opera, for years, there was this, in large capital letters, this this kind of admonition, positively no encores allowed. Now, it has happened, as you say, three times since 1994, and Peter Gelb is now the Met's general manager there in New York, and he is the person who helped bring that whole live in HD series to movie theaters. He is a consummate marketer. And I would not be surprised if he decided to allow this because...
No.
Look, we're all talking about it.
No, they are not. If Juan Diego Flores is well, he's doing the role. It's his role. He's a huge star.
No.
There's no debate about, well, I know you're well and you can sing, but we're going to let him do it. Uh-uh. Not happening.
No bloody way.
Not a chance in a thousand years.
If
he can come off his deathbed, he will be doing it.
What I'm talking about is that Gelb... allowing the encore, thus we're all talking about it. Because Gelb had to be,
he's not standing in the back of the theater every night. I mean, he was probably there. The conductor did not look over at him. It just happened. It just happened. It was so thunderous that they just made it happen. I don't know whether he speaks to him on headset or what. I would doubt it sincerely. I would think clearly they did it in 2008. They did it in 2012. It was so rapturous that they just let the moment happen. You know, they don't want to do it every night for every show, but every once in a while, they know it's, you know, it's a good thing. It gains attention. People talk about it in the media. It's a positive thing.
Well, while Javier Camarena is giving encores of arias, Ben Heppner, who is, you know, speaking of Wagner, he's a leading Wagnerian tenor, and he is going to be retiring at the age of 58. He is one of opera's big names.
Well, he's a Canadian. He's a great singer. He's had a rough time with his voice in the last few years, but he's segued nicely into hosting Canadian radio, where he does Saturday Afternoon at the Opera and Backstage with Ben Heppner. So, you know, he's got a career in opera no matter what. And he's had a long career. I'm not sure how long voices last in the opera. It's incredibly demanding, but I think 58 is not a wildly early age to retire. Even for someone that successful, it's very rare that you would go into your 60s or 70s.
Well, Domingo, you know, the fact that he's still doing it in his 70s is remarkable.
Yes, but it's coasting on past glory.
Ooh, okay.
Well, no, I'm not being catty. That's just, you know, there's not a chance in hell that he's anywhere near to what he was 30, 40 years ago. And of course, the Met is in huge trouble. They'd rather make news for an encore than news for fights with unions. I mean, opera is incredibly troubled right now. Attendance is dropping. At the Met, it's so expensive to put on operas. You have three or four different unions, I think, backstage. Everything is expensive. That people are not coming as much. It's really, really difficult. Opera all over the country, and perhaps, I assume, all over the world, is really struggling to survive. It's been a loss-leading cultural institution for many, many years, but now the losses are really starting to mount up.
Well, right. And so you must be referring to, well, first of all, City Opera there in New York, which we talked about in the past.
They're gone.
They're gone entirely. Mm-hmm. And there are many reasons for that. They lost the lease on, you know, the state theater there.
Opera attendance is, everybody's struggling. Everybody from the Met on down is struggling. Well, some of them are closing shop.
Right. And we're talking about the opera in San Diego, the San Diego Opera, which was the 10th largest opera company in North America. And they are closing and shuttering after 49 years, in large part because of, they just ran out of money.
Well, they're running out. They had an endowment from the widow of Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's.
Right.
And they're starting to dig into that too much. Ticket sales have been dropping and dropping. They sold 34,000 tickets a year ago. And then last season, They sold 34,000 tickets in 2013, which is down from 41,000 in 2010.
Right.
So that's almost a 20% drop, and that's been a long, slow decline. They're not closing up shop yet necessarily. The board said, we're closing up shop. This is it. We have to shut down. We're going to start losing more money than we can afford. It's time to say goodbye. And then there was a revolt. And one of the board members who's put a lot of money to try to keep it afloat said, no, we're going to fight and try to keep it open. Well, that led to 13 board members resigning. Those are the people who said, look, we've got to close up shop. It's the only responsible thing to do. We don't have any money left. And I'm just picturing, how big is this board? 13 people resigned? My God.
Well, anyway, a lot of the money for these operas, because as was pointed out in a New York Times piece here, that only 38% of the cost of putting on an opera comes from ticket sales.
No, that's in San Diego specifically.
That's what I'm saying.
It varies depending on the year and the season. But yes, the operas are every opera you mount loses money.
And so
every single opera.
Right.
So you need endowments, you need gifts, you need grants, you need foundations. You're not making any money by the people in the seats or even with Live in HD. That doesn't, at most you lose less money if it's a really big hit.
Well, and that's why all these board members are around, because they know people and they turn to those people and say, give us money.
You're on the board because you donate a lot of money.
Right.
It's not just that you know people who have money, you have money.
Right.
But anyway,
precisely.
13 of them quit. So I don't know how many are left. But those people are still fighting to figure out a way to keep the San Diego Opera alive. There are other operas around the world. There's Opera Philadelphia. They're commissioning new work. They have an opera about Charlie Parker, the great jazz saxophonist, coming together in 2015, as well as an opera about Andy Warhol. So they're obviously trying to reach new audiences and make new work happen. But opera is a fading art.
Yeah, I do like the fact that in Philadelphia, they're calling the Andy Warhol opera, a popera.
That's right. And of course, if you end up with just a few operas around the world, you've got the Met and you've got, something here and something there, that really doesn't help, because you need a big supply of possibilities for people to train and work and grow. Not everybody's going to leap into the Met right away. Sometimes you develop a repertoire and you develop a talent, or you develop new work and new artists in all these regional operas, which are of high quality. And then at some point, you're ready to jump to the Met. But if you have opera just in a few major cities, almost no one's going to see it, and then no one will care, and then no one will go, and no one will sing. Already, you're finding, when you look at the people who are singing opera, they're almost all people of privilege. There are very few working-class poor people who spring into opera, because they just don't have the possibility. They're not exposed to opera. They don't hear opera. They don't see opera. The idea of singing opera never occurs to them. And so more and more, you're seeing middle and upper-class people are where the only opera singers come from, because it's just not a form that anyone is exposed to. I mean, I certainly never saw opera till I moved to New York.
And that is actually was the big story behind Anna Netrebko, the soprano from Russia, because she was scrubbing the floor.
It happens. It happens. But it's very, very rare today. Whereas you can find in sports and in other areas and movies and other things, people come from everywhere. Opera, they do not. They come from a very rarefied sliver of society, even for the performers now. The people going have to be wealthy, because who the hell can afford it? And the people performing on stage are coming from the world of privilege, because they're the only ones who even know it exists. So it's very, very concerning. There's no solution. We have no suggestions. We have no we have no demands. But opera's really cool. It's just like seeing a musical. It's not some strange, crazy, weird thing that people pretend. You go to a great opera, it's like seeing a great movie or seeing a great musical. It's a great work of art with incredible talent. There's nothing like it. If you ever get to be in a big city and get a chance, take a flyer and go see an opera. Go see Madame Butterfly. You'll find out that it's really great fun.
Yeah, I had subscription to the Los Angeles Opera, and every time I went, it was kind of a big deal.
It's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. It's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story: suddenly, that $100 fee for Amazon Prime seems a little sexier. HBO has just announced a deal with the online site's streaming service. For the first time, HBO programs are available somewhere other than HBO's branded outlets and Blu-ray and home video and DVD. HBO has made a serious chunk of their back catalog available to Amazon. Specifically, entire seasons of shows like The Sopranos and The Wire and miniseries like Band of Brothers, they'll all be on Amazon Prime. Also, HBO Go, which is their online thing for subscribers, that will work on Amazon's Fire TV. But don't look for the latest episode from Game of Thrones. HBO has made clear it will be at least 3 years before any episodes currently airing on the pay channel will have a chance of showing up on Amazon Prime. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop.
What?
Well, they're just talking about way deep catalog. Some shows like Sex and the City are not available, not part of this.
I did notice that, actually, that Sex and City
There's a couple key shows that they're like, the ones you really want are not available. They're not making the entire show available, so you can't binge watch. They're saying, like, here's season one, here's season four, here's season two. It'll be sort of a rotating thing like you see on Hulu, so it makes it sort of hard if you want to power through a whole series. Why not make some money? Amazon probably offered them the moon. It doesn't really mess with their mojo as far as trying to get people to subscribe to HBO, because if you want to see Game of Thrones, you got to subscribe to HBO, at least legally.
Yeah.
So I don't think it makes that big a difference. I think it's just, why not? Why not make some extra money?
This was a big, you know, middle finger flipping the bird to old Netflix. Netflix, which was constantly saying, we're not HBO. You're kind of
They
HBO.
Would have loved HBO, I'm sure they are. And they didn't even negotiate with Netflix, did
right.
they?
No.
They didn't even try to get them in there to bump up the price.
Right. Well, you know, yeah. Well, now the music streaming service Pandora is facing death by a thousand paper cuts. The service is being sued, possibly in state after state after state, by major record labels. The reason? Federal copyright law says Pandora, and all other radio stations, by the way, are free to play recordings released prior to 1972 without paying the record label a fee. So they don't have to pay like a licensing fee or a Well, we'll get into that. They do have to pay publishers and songwriters via publishing arrangements with ASCAP and the like, but not record labels. So record companies are suing Pandora under various legal strategies in state after state after state, most recently with Capitol suing Pandora in New York State. A similar one was filed against SiriusXM last year. If one of the labels can succeed, everyone else is sure to join in and then use that victory to argue their case in other states. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop for me because I don't listen to Pandora.
Ah, okay.
I'm not quite sure why they're trying to destroy it. I mean, they get money from it. They want more money from it. But if they're going to kill it in the cradle, what's the point?
Yeah,
I don't
get it
either. I'm not quite sure what their mojo is. They get a lot of money from Pandora. And a lot of it they get to keep without sharing with the artist. So I'm not quite sure what their problem is.
Yeah, I mean, this is, well, we'll get into this in a moment during Inside Baseball. But this is one of those things where the rules for Pandora are already so different in the way they...
Well, it's a different service. They should be.
And the pre-1972 copyright laws are state-bound, not federal-bound. So that's why they're suing in all these states. Of course, that just runs up Pandora's legal bill and kind of makes it hard.
Right, yeah, they can put them out of business just by suing them in 50 states.
Right.
Yeah.
You know who's not being put out of business?
Who?
Ryan Seacrest. He's like the hardest working man in showbiz since James Brown died. He is taking a long, hard look at all his relationships. Seacrest is said likely to be walking away from the E! Entertainment Channel, even though he was once the face of that very network. His overall deal with NBC Universal is also likely to expire, though he'll continue to produce shows for them like the Kardashian franchise. Can we get him to stop doing that? That is my question.
Not when it makes money.
Yeah, well, that leaves his New Year's show for ABC. Lots of investments in entrepreneurial startups like, Pinterest and Mark Cuban's cable channel. His four-hour-a-day radio show with Clear Channel. And yes, at least two more years with American Idol.
American Idol.
Yes. Seacrest out. Seacrest also wants to create a major network juggernaut of his own and continues
Who doesn't?
He continues to experiment with various projects. All told, he makes more than $60 million a year, and Seacrest says he can't imagine life without Idol. Is Seacrest sticking with Idol a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. He's got so many other things going on. I think it's the right thing for him to do. He says he can't imagine life without Idol. You may wonder, I mean, the ratings are falling day by day on this show. Some weeks it hasn't even been in the top 20. Either episode of Idol has not been in the top 20. I think last week one of them was number 20. Why aren't we talking about Idol being canceled the way we talked about The X Factor being canceled and the way we talk about other shows being canceled? The very one simple reason, American Idol has fallen dramatically, and it is the number one show on Fox.
Oh.
Nobody cancels your number one show, not happily. I mean, shows eventually leave the air sometimes on top, but no network says, please go away, you're the number one show we have. It doesn't happen. So unless, if they want to keep doing it, and they're Idol's, Fox's number one show, Fox is going to keep them on the air.
Motown the Musical has lost a little steam. It shot out of the gate as an audience favorite, but is now regularly beaten at the box office by Kinky Boots and Matilda, two other productions presently on Broadway. But it's still really, this show Motown, it's still in the $1 million club. And if you want to know what that is shows that are grossing more than $1 million a week on Broadway. And that got people's attention. Now, the people behind Rock of Ages, which, by the way, has been on Broadway for 5 years and counting, those producers have snagged the rights to mount a stage show on the iconic TV series Soul Train.
Don Cornelius.
Yes, Don Cornelius. They're still looking for creatives to bring on board, so the train is a long way off from pulling into the station. But what better compliment to Motown, the musical, than a host of imitators? What next? American Bandstand? Hey, maybe we should get Seacrest on that. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, of course. It's just a Broadway show that's, you know, in the works. But, you know, Soul Train ran for 35 years. Wow. And they better get some good dancers, because that's what the show's known for, as much as the stars. It was the people on stage dancing away, doing all the latest dance moves. And in this case, they'll be doing all the classic moves from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So it's logical, you know. Success brings out imitation.
Now, Neil Young launched his Pono Music Service with a Kickstarter campaign that proved wildly successful, which, Michael, we talked about a few episodes ago. Often described as a fundraising effort, the campaign did include some fancy offerings, like dinner and music with Young and the like, but the vast majority of funds were simply early purchases of the Pono Music device. A handful were discounted heavily to $200. Many were personalized, limited editions, linked to certain acts like Bruce Springsteen and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, but they were all pretty much $400. Altogether, it raised more than $6 million, the third highest grossing Kickstarter campaign in history. People weren't funding the startup so much as placing advance orders for what Young promised would be the best digital music playback system people had ever heard. And don't bother buying one for Michael, because I've already bought one for... Wait, what? I've already bought him one? Wait, I guess I should actually read the script before in this copy beforehand. Does this mean I actually do have to buy a Pono player for Michael? And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
The answer is yes, you do have to buy me a Pono player. And I think it's a big whoop. I think it's a big whoop in the sense of, oh, Neil Young, people are angry on Rolling Stone. All the comments are saying, why is this jerk raising money for, you know, why are we funding this? And it's like, I don't understand why they weren't able to spin it properly. It's like, you're just advance ordering a device. That's all. You're not funding it. He's been funding it himself for years. This isn't to help the company get off the ground. It's, do you want to buy a Pono device? Place your advance order here. They did that via Kickstarter, but that's what it was. And they've gotten all this negative press, and they've gotten a lot of it because they didn't present it properly.
Yeah, Kickstarter, the company, has said, we are not a store. You're not buying anything here because, you know what? You're funding.
They may not do it. You may not get it, right? We're not responsible for what. You give them the money, that's your business.
Right.
You know, they're not saying we're not. They're just saying we have nothing to do with anything. So, like, you invest in a company and then they go public and you don't get any money, don't call to us, complain to them. And if you give them money and you don't get a legal piece of the company, you're not investing in the company. That happens. People invest in something, they get really angry when it goes public and makes a lot of dough. In this case, though, Neil Young's just saying, hey, you want to buy a Pono? Give us $400 and we'll ship one to you when it's ready.
Now, live events have become a steady source of income for movie theaters, as we just...
Like opera!
Like opera, that's right. Now, whether they're showing opera or concerts or motivational speakers, now one of the most promising events will be simulcast to theaters around the world. Monty Python will be performing their last concert together on July 20th in London. That show will be simulcast throughout the UK and around the world at the very same time. So you can see the dead parrot sketch and lumberjacks in women's underwear and other classic routines. Spam, 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 and spam.
Spam, 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 spam.
Well, you can see it all at the same time as the lucky few who snag tickets. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Spam, spam. It's a big deal.
That's a big deal. Out of all this stuff, that's the big deal. Okay.
Only for me, because I'm a Python fan. I couldn't get to London. I couldn't get a ticket. I also couldn't get a ticket to Kate Bush. If anyone's going and wants a guest, let me know. But anyway, Monty Python together. I love them. They're really old. This is probably going to be their last hurrah in live theater. And so I would have loved to have been there. And by God, I'll probably go out 3:00 in the afternoon, I imagine, and go to some movie theater and watch it live, because that'll be a lot more fun than watching it on DVD later. I wonder if they thought about going to like HBO or somebody and simulcasting it that way. I wonder why they decided to do movie theaters. Is that proving to be, do you think, more profitable? Is that why they did it this way?
Well, they can do both. This is a one-off event type.
Well, they can't do both. Not live.
Not live. You're right.
Right.
You're
no, right. I'm saying, I wonder if they considered, because in the old days, you would have gone to HBO or Showtime or somebody else and other cable services around the world and said, hey, do you want to show this concert live? Or it would be the first time you could see it anywhere after it was on live. But anyway, that would be the outlet you'd go to. But I guess now you can make more money doing it via theater.
Yeah, that's true.
If there's more money to be made, that's the way to do it.
Now, speaking of money to be made, Prince has finally gotten what he wants from Warner Brothers. The artist formerly known and now forever known as Prince famously grew to vehemently dislike his contract with the record label, performing with the word slave written on his face in protest at one
point.
That's
what we should do in our podcast until we get money for this.
That's right, people. We're not going to. Warner Brothers is holding us back. Warner Brothers is the man. Anyway, that's one reason his classic, you know, Prince's classic catalog of music from the 1970s and 1990s has remained moribund. Never remastered in all these years and barely present on CD. That's all going to change. They've come to new terms, and Warner Brothers will start remastering and reissuing his albums, beginning with Purple Rain, which
Purple
is...
Purple Rain.
Yes, well, guess what? That's celebrating its 30th anniversary this year.
God, I'm old.
Making
oh my
me
God,
feel...
I can remember seeing that in the theater.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
Prince has a new album on the way. Oh, and he gets control and complete ownership of his masters. That's kind of important. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, it's not really a big deal. It's a big whoop, of course, but thank goodness it finally happened. I mean, Warner Brothers could have done this decades ago. He said, I want the masters. If they'd given him the masters, they would have been making money all these years. I mean, they literally, you can't buy 1999 or Purple Rain in anything other than a really crappy old CD made about 25, 30 years ago. These albums are dying to be remastered. I can't wait for them to come out with some extras. I think if Prince has fallen off the radar, part of it has to do with the fact that he's been churning out more anonymous material on independent labels and touring sometimes indifferently and other times with a lot of, you know, fervor and imagination. But the big problem is his music hasn't really been available in a spruced up positive way. So I'm really happy that his back catalog is going to finally get reissued properly.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing, we'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. And boy, oh boy, does this subject affect everybody, especially those in North America.
That's right. We're talking about net neutrality. The FCC made big news because the head of the FCC, who used to be a big honcho working in the cable industry and big proponent of ending net neutrality, he became the head of the SEC, promising he would not do anything to hurt net neutrality. And now they're creating new rules that everybody else is saying are going to end net neutrality. Here's how the New York Times put it. They said, quote, the principle that all internet content should be treated equally as it flows through cables and pipes to consumers looks all but dead. The Federal Communications Commission said on Wednesday that it would propose new rules that allow companies like Disney, Google, or Netflix to pay internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon for special faster lanes to send video and other content to their customers. The proposed changes would affect what is known as net neutrality, the idea that no providers of legal internet content should face discrimination in providing offerings to consumers and that users should have equal access to see any legal content they choose.
Yes, well, and let's keep in mind that this proposal, which is going to be discussed at the FCC's May meeting, it's coming 3 months after the Federal Appeals Court, I think it was in Baltimore or Washington, they struck down, not once, but twice, this the FCC's rules intended to kind of guarantee what they called an open internet. The court said, look, FCC, you did not declare these providers, these internet service providers, as common carriers, the way mail carriers are, or the phone system is. You can't discriminate traffic on phone calls. You can't discriminate against which mail gets to a sender first or last, unless, you know, you're sending it overnight. You can't do that because they're common carriers. Well, very early on in the days of the internet, there was a big outcry from the internet service providers. They didn't want to be considered common carriers.
Because then it would be regulated by the government more closely.
That's right. And so that was a big to-do. And, you know, what the court said was, here's how you can guarantee net neutrality. Here are the steps you can take, or here's where you need to end up. But that is not what Tom Wheeler wants to do. And to kind of, Mike, Michael, you kind of mentioned it already. You said that Tom Wheeler used to be the head of, he was the head lobbyist for the cable industry. The head
now
lobbyist.
Now he's the guy overseeing them and is presumably providing oversight and regulation.
Right. But as we all know, that's a revolving door. And Michael Powell, who used to head up the FCC under George W. Bush, I believe, is now where Tom Wheeler used to be, the head lobbyist for the cable industry.
Which is a complete joke.
Yes. So, and he also was the head of Cydia, you know, Tom Wheeler, the head of Cydia, which is the cellular technology, you know.
Right. Basically. So the FCC says, hey, we're just following the law. We tried to do it the other way and they won't let us do it. And everybody else is saying, you need to state that internet providers are a utility, right? A common carrier. And if they were a utility, they would be more carefully regulated. It would be just a service provided to everybody where there could be a lot more regulation. It would just be a simple service, just like electricity and water.
That's right, because it's kind of hard to operate these days. I mean, a lot of government forms that you need to fill out, you have to get online. You have to go to the internet to fill out a, you know, DMV or passport.
The internet's not even like cable TV. It is really a necessity for people in the modern era.
That's right. Well, what Tom Wheeler did, of course, this was kind of this story broke in the Wall Street Journal. I think it was on Wednesday or Thursday, and all heck broke loose. And Tom Wheeler, head of the FCC, took to the internet, and ironically, and then on his blog,
couldn't upload his blog post. It was moving too slow.
Yes, exactly. He said, "Look, this is to be clear. This is what this notice." As the FCC calls it, will propose. And this is a quoting him. He says, one, that all ISPs must transparently disclose to their subscribers and users all relevant information as to the policies that govern their network.
In other words, tell us when you're screwing us.
Yes. So if you're going to slow down Netflix, let us know. Number two, this is a Trojan horse, by the way, number two, that no legal content may be blocked.
Which means that they want to block illegal content and decide in advance what should be blocked and should not be blocked.
Bingo.
Rather than stopping, you know, something that they consider to be a pirate site, they're just going to block it from coming to you and not let you access it, even though it hasn't been legally blocked yet.
Right, because the DMCA is protecting ISPs today. And so they're saying, look, you know, we have safe harbor. We don't want to have to police what goes through us.
Just like the phone company doesn't listen to who you're talking to.
Right. You couldn't go and you know, sue the phone company or charge the phone company because somebody planned a bank robbery on it. The bank couldn't go to the phone company and say, this is all your fault.
Right.
And you should have stopped these people from talking about the fact that they were going to rob a bank. Well, what this little number two, this little item number two, that's exactly what they're trying to do here.
But that's at the behest of big companies. They want this.
Yes.
The big studios and the big people want to be able to block websites without having the bother of going through the, you know, legal hurdles of actually declaring them illegal.
Correct. Yes. They don't want to have to use the DMCA because it's onerous. There's hundreds of millions of people sharing things online, and they don't want to have to track down every single person.
And what's number three?
That ISPs may not act in a commercially unreasonable manner to harm the internet, including favoring the traffic from an affiliated entity.
So, in other words, internet service providers, do what you think best.
Yeah, because here's my question. Who is going to say what is commercially unreasonable?
The courts, eventually.
Yes. Well, and what this is saying is G Comcast, you're about to buy Time Warner, and you also own NBC Universal. You
have fun with that.
Yeah, you can't like give Hulu or NBC priority over, because you own it, over, say, YouTube, which you don't own.
And this is not some cute little debate. We're talking about a huge driver of industry. And free speech. I mean, the internet is like air. I mean, being able to control what people see and favor one website over another and block websites you don't like, even though they're legally up, that's a very scary proposition. And that's why I've received like four different petitions to sign, you know, like a We the People petition and another petition. And I'm getting emails, help us fight this, you know, from certain liberal groups that I've gotten on their mailing list for and other stuff like that. I mean, I've gotten deluged with people up in arms and freaked out about this, and rightly so.
I agree. This is one of those SOPA and PIPA things. And
I hope so. They should do something like that again. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know, unfortunately.
And what does that mean? To explain to people, remind them?
The Stop Online Piracy Act, which is what number two was all about, then no legal content. And the, what was it? I can't remember what PIPA stood for, but it was basically piracy, internet. I can't remember what PIPA stood for, the acronym, but it was all about seeing what was going through the pipes and stopping the illegal content or pirated content.
And people in protest
said, you can't be doing what you want to do, which is breaking the internet. You can't, you know, send it through all these filters. You can't create two versions of the internet.
And so to protest that, what did they do?
They, you know, stormed the Capitol, literally and figuratively. They basically held rallies and had all these people calling into their congressmen. And so finally...
And all websites went black one day, right?
That's true, yes. Thank you for reminding me that. You know, Wikipedia went black for a day.
And Facebook, and a lot of... Is Facebook too?
I don't know about Facebook. I think Facebook
But
was
a lot of websites went black.
Yes. And at the time, Google was a part of it. And now, of course, Google said, we can't fight this any longer, so we'll pay Comcast and we'll pay, you know, for YouTube. Netflix is already paying Comcast. And of
course...
That's
right. They were blackmailed by Comcast. Comcast let all their service deteriorate so that Netflix would really suck for its customers, which meant they got angry at Netflix, even right. though Comcast was the one doing it. And that forced Netflix to come to them and pay them extra money so that their service would go be back up to snuff again.
Yeah. And, you know, they said, we're not doing anything illegal. We're just not going to upgrade our systems to, you know, to kind of take care of Netflix.
And not that they needed to. They didn't lay any new lines. They didn't add capacity into anything. But once Netflix started paying up, guess what? Their speed jumped dramatically, and now everything's fine again.
Right. And you have Reed Hastings saying, well, AT&T is too slow and, you know, basically pointing the finger at AT&T.
Now, Netflix has been very busy. Of course, the net neutrality is incredibly important to them. They've spoken out against the Comcast-Time Warner cable merger.
As well they should.
Even though they've been paying them money. They're surely in favor of net neutrality and against these new rules. I don't know if they've released an official statement yet. And they're trying to work on some workarounds. One thing they're exploring is peer-to-peer sharing for its content. I have no idea how this would work.
Oh, my
peer-to-peer
gosh. That's
is when, like... You and I have copies of a digital album on our thing, and when someone new wants a copy, they download and access it to us, from us, rather than going to a central server, right?
Right. It's basically Napster. Well, Napster was client server. Yeah, so rather than Napster, it would be torrenting. That's basically...
Has a commercial site ever used peer-to-peer sharing to get its content out to the world?
Oh, absolutely. Spotify uses peer-to-peer, although they're going away from that. So they just announced... this week that they're going away from peer-to-peer on the desktop. They never used peer-to-peer on mobile. They would do it desktop to desktop. So yeah, it was a way to send content faster. It was a way to not tax the servers. You know, there was many reasons why you would do peer-to-peer in that regard. I think they want more control over it. So they're going to do client to server, you know, basically a hub and spoke system.
Well, Netflix had to pony up a lot of money to Comcast just to get their service back up to snuff. So it turns out they're also raising their prices.
Yes.
For the first time since 2010. And it's probably an overdue time. They've, you know, recovered their market share. Not their market share, but they've recovered their stock price and they've been adding customers. So it's not unreasonable or it may not necessarily be linked. Even if Comcast hadn't happened, they might still be raising their fees because it's been 3-4 years. So they are raising their fees to as much as $10 per month.
Yes, 35 million subscribers here in the U.S., 48.35 million streaming subscribers worldwide. Streaming, not
right.
DVD by mail. So
those
yeah.
are two different subscriptions.
Right. They're making a lot of money.
Well, they're making money, and they're raising their price. And $10 a month is, you know, not a lot if you think it's worthwhile. They're also talking to Chelsea Handler. Everybody was wondering where she was going to go after she left her cable show. Now she's in talks with Netflix. It's all but a done deal, though they haven't signed on the dotted line, that she'll do some sort of talk show, some sort of format for Netflix.
Yes.
And in case you're worried about them shelling all this money, don't worry because Maryland has ponied up. We talked about Maryland and the state legislature and how they were being held hostage by Netflix, who said, if you don't give us a bunch of money, we're going to take House of Cards and film it elsewhere because some other state will give us money. Well, Maryland ponied up. They came up with $11.5 million to offer House of Cards in various ways for the following season of the show. So they will remain in Maryland and be filming there.
Wow. Okay. Well, the big story here is, of course, the FCC. And I just, it's remarkable to me. How does this apply to those outside of the U.S.? Well, first of all, Brazil and Europe, congratulations. Brazil basically put into law net neutrality. So good for you, Brazil.
And well, we should snag the wording of that if we like it and be passing that around and proposing it for here.
Right. And over in Europe, they're about to do the same thing. But, you know, other countries will look at what the FCC is doing and see what what these companies got away with. See what the, you know, what was legislated and what wasn't. Really, Tom Wheeler is saying, I don't want to have to take the hard road. The hard road would be to make all of these ISPs common carriers. That would be the hard road. The hard road, and one thing that I think would actually create and maybe not make any of this matter, is if there was actual competition in the marketplace. There is no competition in the marketplace. Michael, you nor I have any say in which internet service provider we can actually use. We could try. I can't use AT&T UVerse. Doesn't come to my area. Can't use Verizon Fios. Doesn't come to my area.
You got to get a whole building to switch to DirecTV if you're in a big city.
That's right.
You know, you can't just decide to do DirecTV. You got to get your whole building to sign on for it.
So I think if the FCC turned to these internet service providers, these cable providers, and said, look, we know you dug all these trenches and laid all this fiber. You've gotten that money back already. Now we're going to let Time Warner Cable and Comcast, which are going to be the same, and Verizon Fios, they're all going to be available to the same customer, and you can duke it out by competition. Then it wouldn't matter, but it does matter.
Well, no, I think it would matter anyway. I think that may be what you want as well. Competition's always better if it's possible to open up that last, you know, mile to the customer after all the line has been laid. But I think you still want net neutrality. You still want them to be designated utility. You still want rules in place for net neutrality. I wouldn't say, oh, if you have big multinational corporations fighting out to get customers, we don't have to worry about net neutrality. I don't think that's true.
Yeah. Well, I would, yes, what you said. That's basically, I mean, I think this will, you know, basically.
It's a fight. People got to fight. People got to call their congressman. They got to, you know, I passed around a petition. I never do that.
Yes.
I never, ever share political stuff or anything except like, here, read my new story. I did that on Facebook once. I'll do it again. You know, it seems like a mild thing, but you reach a couple hundred people. They think it's important. They sign up. They pass it along. It makes a big difference.
What
if a couple million
saying,
people sign a petition on wethepeople.gov, I don't even like the wording of the petition that's up there now, but it shows people are paying attention.
Well, and really what this does is YouTube and the Yahoos, Googles, and Facebooks of the world would never have been able to start, because as soon as they got popular, they would be double charged, once by their host and once by Comcast or Time
Warner.
Well,
they'd never be able to succeed, because they wouldn't be able to offer the same service as an already established YouTube. So the new company that comes up will have crappy service. You're not going to go to a website to look at videos when the videos keep stuttering and stopping.
Right.
You'll go to YouTube because they're going to work great. And now YouTube has the money to do that. So they will never succeed because they can't offer what other people are offering. It's scary. It's like putting a lock on the door of the library. Nobody would dream of letting that happen and letting them put a lock on the door to the internet to block it off and to control it for big companies. It's a scary proposition.
Yeah, well, I agree. You know what's not scary, though?
What?
Is that we've come to the end of this week's show.
Huh.
Now, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes.
For the moment. Who knows how our show will work once net neutrality fails.
Oh, yeah, well, you won't be able to hear us.
That's right. Well, see, we'll talk.
Well, you know, if you do want to hear us, at least until net neutrality fails, you can certainly subscribe to us in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free or aggregate podcasts. That's where you can find the show, Showbiz Sandbox. And we do ask that you rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us or ways to follow us. We're on Twitter, where our username is at Showbiz Sandbox. We're on Facebook, where you can like us. We have a page, Showbiz Sandbox. Search for it. You'll find us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can talk to us directly via voicemail. So I guess it's not directly. It's somewhat indirectly. 888-567-SAND is the phone number. I almost said email address, but 888-567-7263. That is our phone number. Again, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff can be found on showbizsandbox.com. Our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz has a website every week. It's a rotating website. What is it this week, Michael?
It's net neutrality, now and forever, one and inseparable.com.
That's awfully long. So if
it doesn't load properly,
Yeah, if it doesn't, yeah, if it's slowed down at all. Try michaelgiltz.com or the Huffington Post for some of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.